It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the number of high school girls in Wisconsin who wrestle is on the rise. We'll talk with one of the wrestlers and an athletic director about the push to create a girls' division in the state. First, the heads of Wisconsin's election and ethics commissions are likely to lose their jobs. On January 23rd, the state Senate plans to reject the confirmation of Michael Haas, head of the Elections Commission, and Brian Bell, head of the Ethics Commission. Both have been under scrutiny since secret information about the John Doe investigation was leaked to the Guardian newspaper. Patrick Marley has been following the story. He covers state politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
How certain does it seem that the heads of those two commissions will be losing their jobs?
Well, it looks very likely that the Senate's going to vote next week to try to remove them. I think, you know, both of those guys would say that they're doing everything they can to try to keep their jobs and persuade senators to go in a different direction. At this moment, it looks like the vote will be held, and it looks like it would be very difficult for them to get the votes to stay on.
So it sounds like they don't have the confidence of the GOP leadership, but they do have the confidence of their commission members. Is that correct?
That's right. Both of them work for a commission that consists of three Republicans and three Democrats. Those commissions have unanimously said they support these guys. Just in even recent days, they have issued statements or taken votes to say that they're fully behind them. There's no dissent in those ranks. But in the state Senate, which the Republicans control 18 to 13, it's very hard to find any Republican who stands behind those guys.
The commissioners on those commissions are appointed by the two parties, correct? So there are actually GOP-appointed members of those commissions.
Yes, there are three Republicans that are on there. One was appointed by the governor, one was appointed by the Senate leader, and one was appointed by the Assembly Speaker for each commission. So, yes, they have direct ties to the people who are now trying to oust them.
And would those positions be dissolved in some way, or would new people be put in those positions to replace them?
So what would happen is, it's a little unclear. The Republican senators would say that when they have that vote, the two lose their jobs, and then it's up to the commission to hire a new people. Some contend that the Senate vote actually would not have that effect and that they would continue in their job. That would just be sort of a public no-confidence vote. The chairman of the Elections Commission has raised the prospect that the state Senate would need to sue that commission to oust Michael Haas. I think I talked to Michael Haas recently and asked him if he would really stick around and stick through that. He was reluctant to say what he would do if he loses his vote, saying he's kind of taking things one day at a time. So we'll see what it all comes to there. But you certainly could have a court fight here. There's also the possibility that the Senate would throw these people out and that the commissions would turn around and rehire the same people. Mm. And it's also possible that they would have a deadlock. I mean, these commissioners, particularly the Democratic commissioners, are going to be very frustrated that these guys who they view as totally nonpartisan have been thrown out. And, then you could have the commissions deadlocking and unable to hire a new person. In that case, a panel of lawmakers would get to appoint a temporary person into these positions.
We're talking with Patrick Marley from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about GOP Senate plans to oust the heads of the Elections Commission and the Ethics Commissions here in Wisconsin. And Patrick, so we've talked about what might happen, but why? Why are we in this position? Why do GOP senators want to drive them out of their posts?
Right. I think that's a great question. So all of this goes back to the John Doe investigations that were conducted of the governor and other Republicans related to campaign activity. Before we had these commissions, we had an entity called the Government Accountability Board. It worked with prosecutors on an investigation into whether Republicans had been working too closely with conservative groups in elections. The state Supreme Court threw out the investigation, stopped it, saying there was nothing illegal, that the investigation was a total overreach. This greatly frustrated Republicans around the state. They thought that it was a witch hunt, and Governor Walker and the Republicans in the legislature did a few things about that. They changed the John Doe law, and they dissolved the Government Accountability Board and created these two new commissions that were equally represented by Republicans and Democrats to make a more, something that they viewed as more fair.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, well, then you had this leak of material, this investigation that was conducted of the governor and others. Millions of pages of documents were gathered, and they were kept under seal. But a large number of documents, about 1,300 pages of documents, were leaked to the Guardian newspaper, which published them. That prompted the Attorney General, Brad Schimmel, to do an investigation to find out how that material was leaked. He was unable to determine who specifically leaked it, but said it came from the Government Accountability Board. This sort of stirred up all of the old anger about that board and led Republican senators to say they want Brian Bell and Mike Haas to go because they formerly worked for the Accountability Board, although they didn't really have much to do with the John Doe investigation.
Well, and even if they worked for the board, they certainly weren't the only two employees. So what have Haas and Bell done to try to clear their names or respond to these charges?
So Haas makes the point that he was not involved in the core team that did the investigation of the John Doe, that what he was involved with is when that investigation was brought into a legal challenge, when targets of the probe brought their case that was ultimately successful to the state Supreme Court, he helped them review their legal documents and their filings as to why the investigation was appropriate. And he says, I'm a lawyer representing a client. All the time state attorneys at the Department of Justice, for instance, lose cases and we don't chase them out of their jobs because their clients were found to have not done something the right way. He's been at the elections agency for 9 years, and he says, look, I've been at the center of all kinds of controversies, from voter ID to these recounts to the recalls. He says, I've treated people fairly, and people on both sides of the aisle who have ever interacted with me have said that I've treated them fairly, and that's shown by this bipartisan support I have from the Elections Commission. So that's the way he lays it out. Brian Bell worked for the Accountability Board, but in separate divisions, and did not have anything to do with the John Doe investigations. The criticism of him mounts from how he responded to the leak investigation. That the Department of Justice, it took them some time to get a hold of records that the Ethics Commission had inherited from the Government Accountability Board, and Republican state senators say that they didn't turn over material fast enough. Bell says these records were kept in a mess. I was legally barred from reviewing some of them because they were under seal. And as soon as I found out what I had, I gave it to the Department of Justice, but I wasn't able to find out any of this sooner.
So these two commissions, the Ethics Commission and the Elections Commission, came to be after, as you said, the Government Accountability Board was dissolved. In following these stories, do you feel like these two new commissions have been fulfilling the mission that they were given?
Well, it's very interesting because they're in their infancy, right? They were created just last year, maybe 18, 19 months ago. So I think it's hard to judge them at this time. But one thing I would say is that when they got rid of the Accountability Board and created the two commissions, the Democrats in the legislature were very critical of the move and said that we'd just have all this partisan infighting. You'd have these things tie up 3-3 on any controversial issue. And it's been pretty remarkable how consistent these two commissions have been in being united on various issues, not just with Brian Bell and Mike Haas, but other activities that they have done. You haven't seen the kind of partisan rancor that you see in a legislative meeting, for instance. So they have gotten along a lot better than their critics might have guessed. This is going to be the biggest test for them. as to how things play out here and then how the individual commissioners react to it.
And so on the 23rd, the state Senate will take a vote on this. And if they do decide not to confirm them, what happens immediately after?
I think we don't know. I think that, there's going to be a question about, is there a transition period? Well, first of all, are Brian Bell and Mike Haas going to stick around? Are they going, either of them going to contend that they can stay put? We don't know that. If they could take the position that they don't think they're ousted, but a message has been sent and they want to leave. They could believe that they are ousted and go, or they could say, no, I've done nothing wrong, and this vote is meaningless, and stay there. In that case, I think you'd have a legal fight pretty quick if they refused to leave. If they do agree to go, if the vote comes that way and they agree to go, I think there'll be questions about, well, does that mean that very minute they're out? Do they have any kind of transition period? And then the commissions will have to start turning to hiring replacements for them.
Well, Patrick, thanks so much for joining us today.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
Patrick Marley covers state politics for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us to talk about the heads of Wisconsin's elections and ethics commissions. They're both at risk of losing their jobs, given that the state legislature is not likely to reconfirm their appointments. The 45th annual Badger State Invitational Wrestling Tournament was held in December at Stoughton High School, and for the first time, it included a separate division for girls. With more girls taking part in wrestling around the state, there's been an increased push for creating an official division under the WIAA that would let female wrestlers compete against each other throughout the season, including at the state tournament. Mel Dow is the athletic director at Stoughton High School, and he helped organize the Badger State Invitational. Mel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
Alexa Flores was the champion of her weight class at that tournament. She's a senior at Madison La Follette High School, and the latest wrestling rankings places her at 14th in the class nationwide. She's in the studio with us. Alexa, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So, Alexa, let's start with you. What first drew you to wrestling?
Well, for 3 years before I started wrestling, I had watched my brothers wrestle, and I always had the itch, but I never really pursued it until I started seeing Ronda Rousey. You know, she started getting really big, and I was like, Dad, I want to do that. And he said, all right, well, first you have to start wrestling so that you get a strong base for something before we can pursue anything else. So, like, the next day I was right in the gym practicing with the guys at La Follette.
So you've been doing that for almost 4 years. What's that been like for you?
It's been really good. You know, I have a lot of support behind me, like my coach Dante Sciro, Jim Radwell, and then my previous coach, Gary Skiles, and all the teammates are awesome, and my parents. So.
And what about your friends? What have they had to say about it?
I don't know. I mean, it's just kind of, they think it's cool and unique, and I guess they see it more than I do, but yeah.
And Mel, what's the feeling among coaches about creating a girls' division?
You know, it's actually growing in popularity. I just got back into town from a meeting up at the WI office where it was one of the topics of discussion that's taking place in the state, and it was very encouraging to hear the positive response. I gave a breakout report on how our tournament went down here in Stoughton, and, we're one of many states in the United States that are looking at adding a girls' division. There are currently seven across the country that actually have a girls' division within their high school programming. And we're pretty confident that if this moves forward, it'll help us grow the numbers in the sport.
Mel, why do you think there is growing interest among girls to wrestle?
I feel girls see it as a viable way for them to be active. Our girls are competitive, and they're looking for an avenue for them to excel. At the national and international level, our women's programming has really taken off here in the United States, and we've had some incredible role models, and young women in our country are following that lead.
How many girls are taking part in wrestling in Wisconsin today? Do we have a sense of the numbers?
You know, the final numbers are not in, but we know that, you know, there were over 150 girls that signed up for their high school wrestling teams this past winter. And we're still waiting to see what the final number of girls that actively involved in wrestling is for the year. We know that both with boys and girls, those that sign up and those that actually finish out the season and compete is a different number. But in our tournament here at Stoughton that day, we had 37 girls competing. We had 44 sign up, but for various reasons, only 37 competed. And at the time, that was what we figured to be over a quarter of the girls in the state competed.
Mel Dow is the athletic director at Stoughton High School, and he helped organize the Badger State Invitational for wrestling in December. And Alexa Flores is a senior at Madison La Follette High School, and she was the champion of her weight class at that wrestling tournament. And Alexa, I want to turn back to you. You've competed against both boys and girls. Are there different strategies that you use depending on who you're wrestling against?
I would definitely say yes. I mean, wrestling with the guys, they biologically like have a lot more upper body strength and stuff like that, so girls have to more rely on their technique more and making sure that we get in on a shot and, you know, finish with it right away. And some moves you can't really necessarily do on girls because they're very flexible and they can squirm out really easily. So it's just interesting to see the different styles per se.
Have you noticed boys wrestling against you differently than they do against other boys? Do they have to make those same kind of adjustments when they're wrestling you?
I would say yes, but, you know, there's different types of wrestlers, so, you know, one, they could come out just the same. And some people, they're kind of antiquated, and they see, like, oh, a girl, it'll be an easy match, or, you know, and it's just good to go at them and, you know, prove them wrong.
So, Mel, what needs to happen to actually create a separate wrestling division for girls in the state?
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons why we're trying to pilot these four tournaments across the country, is to demonstrate that there is an interest in our female population in order to have it. You know, as school districts and the WIA, we have to find that balance between what is wanted and what is able to be afforded. And it's not necessarily just financially, but just feasibly, you know, to be able to host a division that can support. And, you know, this initial piloting of this is hopefully going to entice more young ladies to say, you know what, I did wrestle when I was younger, and if there's an avenue for me, we can start getting them to draw into their programs and participate. But, you know, I think we just need more numbers, more people to participate. I think the overwhelming support's going to be there. We just have to demonstrate that it's going to have some sustainability to move forward.
And, Alexa, you're graduating this year, so if there is a new division created, you will have graduated and won't take part in that. But do you think it's important for girls to have their own division to be able to compete in?
For sure. I think that with the pilot of this program and other programs, hopefully it'll be substantial, and that the numbers of girl wrestlers will flourish and then create different opportunities and avenues for wrestling in college and just having that opportunity for girls to be on a more equal platform.
Do you think there are other girls your age or maybe a little older who, if they had seen girl wrestlers, might have thought, oh, that's a sport I'd like to get into?
Definitely. I have people that talk to me, like younger people who want to, and I just tell them, go ahead. And other people are like, dang, you know, I only had a guys wrestling team. I wish I could have done that. So, yeah, just having the opportunities there will definitely increase the numbers.
And Mel, as a coach, what do you see as the most important reasons to have an actual separate division?
Opportunity and equality. I was fortunate enough that back when I was a collegiate wrestler myself, we were one of the first, and many claim that we were the first college program to have a female wrestler in Jackie Berube up in UW La Crosse in the early 90s. And she went on and she competed at the international level for the United States. And so, you know, it's been something that it's just been part of who I am naturally, because it was how I came up through the sport. And, you know, that's what we want to do is we want to provide opportunities for kids to receive the benefits of all sports. But with one this particular is now that it's such a large Olympic movement, why not provide it?
And Mel, as a coach, do you find yourself needing to give girls different types of encouragement just because this is a newer sport for them and they might not have as much support from people around them who think maybe girls shouldn't be wrestling or they're just not used to the idea yet?
Well, you know, each situation is a little bit different. Everybody needs a little different type of encouragement, a little bit type of coaching, and that's both on and off the mat. We are seeing young ladies that are coming in that are well more seasoned than even some of the young men on the team, especially with Alexa. She's an incredible athlete, and she does a great job out there. So there are some coaching points that she doesn't need that, you know, some young men new to the sport will need. So, you know, that's one of the unique things about the sport is it's so independent, but, you know, you need a support cast around you to succeed.
And Alexa, what do your brothers think of you following in their footsteps?
I don't know. It's just kind of the whole family's involved, so we cheer each other on. And, you know, when my brothers are out there, my heart starts beating just as much as when I'm on the mat. So I think everyone around me is very supportive, so I love it.
And once you finish with high school, do you think you'll find ways to continue, like you said, maybe doing mixed martial arts and things like that?
Definitely, yeah. I mean, the avenue's there for me with my coach, Dante Scarrow. He's an MMA as well. But also staying involved with the Lancer Youth Wrestling Club that we have and maybe even being more involved in that. So, yeah.
Well, Alexa, thanks so much for being here and good luck with the rest of your season.
Thank you very much.
And Mel, thanks so much for joining us.
Yep, thank you.
Mel Dow is the athletic director at Stoughton High School, and Alexa Flores is a senior at Madison La Follette. They joined us to talk about the possibility of creating a girls' wrestling division in Wisconsin. President Trump's distaste for the Iran nuclear deal is no secret, having called it, quote, the worst deal ever. But on Friday, the president kept the deal alive when he waived sanctions on Iran for the third time. Under the deal, U.S. presidents sign off on suspending key sanctions, and in exchange, Iran restricts its nuclear program. But Trump said it was the last time he would sign off on the deal. In a statement, he said he renewed it this time only to, quote, secure our European allies' agreement to fix the terrible flaws of the Iran nuclear deal. This is a last chance. Trita Parsi is the founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of the book Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. He's here to tell us what the future of the deal looks like. Trita, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Do you think the president wants to keep the deal in place with some modifications?
No, I don't think about that at all. I think what this is that the president has found out that there's a way for him to kill this deal without looking as if he's killing the deal. And that is this continuous uncertainty that he's creating about the durability.
Go ahead, Trita.
Sorry?
Go ahead. We had just a little blip there.
Yeah, okay. I was just saying that by constantly creating this debate as to whether he will stick to the deal or not, every time there's a deadline coming up, it's all to the wire, you know, whether he will renew the waivers or not. This is a deliberate strategy that makes it very uncertain about whether this deal can survive or not. And that uncertainty actually functions as a de facto sanction because it's deterring international companies to go into the Iranian market, and it's making it very difficult for the Iranians to be able to attract investments into Iran. Banks in particular are not willing to finance any investments because these investments are going to last for 5 to 10 years. And if they don't even know if the deal is going to survive for another 3 months, it doesn't make financial sense for them to go in to these ventures. So it has had the effect of keeping international companies out, which means the Iranians are not getting the financial and economic benefit of complying with this deal. And Trump's hope is that after a while, the Iranians will grow so frustrated so that they will walk out of the deal instead of him having to kill it. Because if they walk out of the deal, they will be blamed for it, and the cost will be on their shoulders, not on Donald Trump's.
I would say, though, that it doesn't seem like President Trump really shies away from doing things that might not be viewed well, either domestically or internationally. He seems ready and willing to be a lightning rod in a lot of these cases. Why not? If he really does want to get out of this deal, why doesn't he just do it now instead of creating what is essentially a 120-day delay?
Because he's been saying that he would do it all the time, and every time he's doing a 120-day delay. And after a while, we have to ask ourselves, is it just a coincidence that the exact same thing happens three times in a row, or is it actually a deliberate strategy? I agree with you. If it was up to him, he would probably have just done it himself, because he doesn't think very far. But because of the other people in the cabinet, particularly Tillerson, McMaster, Kelly, and Mattis, I think they are weighing in on him heavily, precisely because they, unlike him, are very much aware of what a tremendous disaster it would be for the United States if it was responsible for the collapse of this deal. We're not talking about another angry tweet. We're not talking about some of these other things that he does that create scandals. This will create an international crisis in which the United States will find itself completely isolated and at odds with Russia, China, France, Germany, and the UK all at the same time. That's why I think they've been managing, succeeding in weighing in on him to do it this other way instead, in which they shift the cost, they shift the blame onto the Iranians.
We're talking with Trita Parsi of the National Iranian American Council and author of the book Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. We're talking about the Iran nuclear deal and what its fate may be. And Trita, as we said, President Trump said that the reason, one reason at least, that he was renewing it now for this last time was to give European allies a chance to help fix the deal. Do you think European allies have any incentive or desire to negotiate what would be considered a better deal by President Trump?
In order to fix a deal, the deal needs to be broken. When a deal is not broken, you don't fix it. That's the attitude of the Europeans. They don't see any problem with this deal that needs this type of a fixing. The Iranians have lived up to their end of the bargain. Nine reports by the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, has confirmed that the Iranians are living up to the deal, and as a result, the deal is working. They don't see Trump having credibility when he says that he wants to fix the deal. When he says he wants to fix the deal, if you want to believe that, you have to first be convinced that he's actually looking for a better deal. That's not the impression the Europeans or, frankly, anyone else has. They see him as someone that is just inherently opposed to anything that has Barack Obama's name on it. And as a result, he's looking for various ways of killing it. When he sent it to Congress, Congress realized that Trump was trying to make sure that they would join him in killing it so that he wouldn't be blamed alone. And guess what Congress did? Congress didn't do anything. They had 60 days to be able to pass new sanctions. Congress has rarely failed to pass new sanctions. This time they did. Why? Because they don't want to be directly responsible for the crisis that will ensue once they destroy this deal. And the Europeans don't want to be responsible for the crisis that will ensue once this deal is destroyed. So they're also staying away from any false pretense of trying to fix a deal that already is fixed.
So spell out for us, Trita, what you see the disaster is that would ensue if this deal is scrapped.
Well, what this deal did in its simplest term is that it prevented two very negative outcomes from becoming reality. It took them off the table. Outcome number one was that the Iranians would have a pathway to a nuclear weapon. Outcome number two was that the United States and Iran would go to war with each other. If you destroy this deal, those two bad outcomes come back onto the table. And in some ways, it would probably be much worse, because one of the things that could help prevent a deal, a war previously, was the fact that diplomacy had not been exhausted. If we actually have a deal, and as a result of Trump's sabotage, it is destroyed, there's a good chance that there really isn't any diplomatic option going forward. And that significantly increases the risk of war. To many members of Congress, when this was sent over to them by Trump, it was kind of like the 2002 vote on giving George W. Bush authority to use force against Iraq. It's a vote that most members of Congress deeply regret because they became responsible, co-responsible for the Iraq war disaster. And that's not just Republicans. There were plenty of Democrats who voted for this as well. A vote to kill this deal would be a very similar vote in terms of its implications and its political ramifications.
And Trita, do you think that Iran wants to stay in the deal?
I think the Iranians want to stay in the deal, granted that the U.S. is living up to its end of the bargain. If the United States is not living up to the end of the bargain, there is still a small chance that they will stay in the deal as long as they continue to be able to trade and have investments from Europe and other places. But that is becoming increasingly a question mark, precisely because of the way that Trump quite successfully is deterring international banks and businesses to go into the Iranian market. Right now, we're not seeing any signs that the Iranians are pulling out, but that may change because political dynamics in Iran are likely going to change if this situation continues for another year or so, and the Iranians feel that they're living up to the end of the bargain. The IEA confirms that, but they're not getting the economic benefits for doing so.
Trita Parsi is founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. We're looking at the future of the Iran nuclear deal after President Trump said he was renewing it for a final time. Tell us what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you think that the president should have signed off on the Iran nuclear deal? Why or why not? Do you think the U.S. will completely kill the deal? And if we do, does that concern you? Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We're continuing the conversation with Trita Parsi, founder and president of the National Iranian American Council. And we're looking at the future of the Iran nuclear deal after President Trump said he is renewing it one last time. Tell us what you think about the Iran nuclear deal at 800-642-1234 or by email at ideas@wpr.org. Do you think the deal should stay or not? Do you agree with the president's decision to sign off on the deal this one last time? Are you worried about what could happen if the deal is scrapped? Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And let's go to the phone, and Saeed in Green Bay is up. Hi, Saeed.
Yes, thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I think you have just listened to a very articulate representation of the view of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is not the view that is shared by the majority of the people in Iran. And the Iran nuclear deal signed by Obama was very detrimental in many ways. We lost the coalition that had essentially caused the containment of Iran. Since we have signed this deal, we have lost that containment, and the $150 billion of Iranian national wealth that was frozen in the United States, that is given now to the Islamic Republic of Iran, has turned into bombs that have fallen on the heads of defenseless people in Syria. They have translated into rockets that are launched from Yemen into the airport in Riyadh. Havoc is being raised regionally very significantly, but most importantly, this money is being funneled into the oppressive security apparatus that is keeping the people of Iran in chains. So for those freedom seekers that risk their lives on the streets of Tehran, Rasht, Mashhad, Abadan, Ahvaz, all those cities, these dollars translated into a security apparatus that is imprisoning them, that is torturing them, that is obstructing their aspirations for democracy and freedom.
All right, Saeed, thank you for that call. And let's have Trita Parsi respond to that.
Thank you so much. Well, I'm quite stunned by this assessment because it is so far out of the mainstream. We have plenty of polls that have shown that this was a tremendously popular deal in Iran. In fact, there are plenty of images of the Iranian people dancing on the streets of Tehran when the deal was signed and it was announced. Moreover, systematic polls have shown that this is a deal that had an approval rating of 75% plus. There is disappointment today with the deal, but that's precisely because the economic benefits have not come through. Then the caller mixes up a whole set of different issues. First of all, there were no American money that was frozen, Iranian money that was frozen in the U.S. that was given to the Iranians. What was is that there was money that the Iranians had in foreign banks that were frozen as part of the sanctions, and as part of the deal, they got access to their own money. It wasn't American money that was sent there. When it comes to many of the other regional issues that the United States does have problems with Iran's policies, the idea was that once you have secured a nuclear deal, you're actually paving the way for additional diplomacy in order to be able to address those issues. The alternative to this is actually to go to war. And if that's what people want, I think it would be much better for them to be able to spell that out instead of trying to pretend that they're speaking for the people of Iran. The people of Iran clearly did not want war with the United States. They wanted to make sure that this was resolved peacefully. They want to connect with the outside world. They don't want to live in this type of repressive situation that they're in right now. It is not only repressive from the government side, but is also isolated because of the tensions that exist with the outside world. That's precisely why they supported the deal.
And thank you for that call, Saeed. And Trita, this announcement by President Trump that he is he's waiving the sanctions one last time also happened when there are major anti-government protests going on in Iran. What is the relationship between those two, or do they play off each other in any way?
There is a relationship between the two in the sense that there has been a growing economic discontent. Most of that is because of corruption inside of Iran, because of mismanagement, because of cronyism, and because of very, very bad and growing income inequality and wealth inequality inside of Iran. But part of it is also as a result of the way that Donald Trump has been sabotaging the nuclear deal. Because in order to be able to push down unemployment, for instance, which is usually one of the most important reasons as to why people go to the streets for economic reasons, the Iranians needed investments, but the investment is not coming in because of the uncertainty. So the Rouhani government has succeeded in pushing down inflation significantly, but that usually comes at the expense of increased unemployment. They needed investments in order to be able to counter that. The investments didn't come in mainly as a result of the uncertainty around the deal, which then Donald Trump created.
Let's go back to the phones, and Zach in Waupaca is up. Hi, Zach.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think Trump, as the businessman, has shown that he uses bankruptcy as a tool for speculation for windfall deals, as he would probably put it. And I think he's clearly shown in a couple different ways. He's using nuclear war as a threat, as the same type of tool to strong-arm countries into doing what he likes. And I just think that's not only dangerous, there's going to be a backlash. You can't just strong-arm whole cultures into doing what you want them to do instead of coming together and agreeing on what you can agree on, for instance, human rights.
Thanks for that call, Zach. So an interesting point there. Trita, do you think there are points where the U.S. and Iran could work together to build that relationship instead of it all focusing around this particular deal?
Well, in order for them to be able to focus on other things, which I think would definitely be in the national interest of the United States, the Iranians were some of the most efficient forces fighting ISIS, for instance, and they were doing it together with the U.S., but without coordination. In order to be able to do more of that, first, we need to make sure that this deal remains in place, because if the deal collapses, then we're going to end up in a much, much more negative situation, and then I think it's going to be impossible to expect any collaboration, even if it may lie in the interest of the two sides to collaborate. I think the caller is quite right, though. This is a very reckless and dangerous way of trying to coerce other nations to do what you want. And what's important to understand here, Trump is not trying to coerce just Iran to do what he wants. He's trying to coerce the Russians, the Chinese, the French, the Brits, the Germans, all at the same time. And the end result is quite predictable. All of them have united against the United States, which is a very bizarre situation. They all used to be united against Iran. Now they're united against Trump.
It's been reported that the White House actually wants a new deal with Iran that would cover Iran's ballistic missiles as well, not just nuclear weapons. Is that a fair ask, or would that get any traction?
Well, again, I personally think that there may have been a chance of being able to secure an additional deal that is not dependent on this deal, that is separate. But in order for us to be able to achieve such a deal, we first need to have credibility. And that credibility is based on us living up to the first deal. No one's going to negotiate a second deal with the United States if the United States destroys the first deal. This is part of the reason why this is so dangerous also for this situation with North Korea. If the United States destroys the existing deal with Iran, why would the North Koreans even bother to engage in diplomacy with the United States when the U.S. doesn't have the credibility of being trustworthy and being seen as a country that lives up to its word? That's another reason, I think, why Mattis and others have been pushing Trump not to kill the deal outright, precisely because of the way it would so negatively affect the situation with North Korea.
Let's go back to the phones, and Wayne in Marshfield is up. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. I agree 100% with your guest. President Trump is a disruptor, and any time he does it all the time. He blames this on the previous administration, on this, on President Obama, and he's a disruptor, pulling out of the Paris Agreement, the TPP, and anything he can disrupt, he does it. He doesn't think ahead. He doesn't plan ahead. He just works in the minute and doesn't even consider consequences.
Thanks for that call, Wayne. And Trita?
What the caller just said is a very common perspective in Europe right now, in which part of the reason why they're putting up such a fierce resistance against Trump when it comes to the Iran deal is because they believe, well, if he destroys the Iran deal, he's just going to move on and destroy the next deal and the next deal and the next one. And eventually there's not going to be any international agreements at all. And without international agreements and collaboration, we're going to live in a much, much more dangerous world. So this is part of the reason why the Europeans are taking this very, very seriously, because they're so afraid that this is just yet another step of Trump destroying deals that really constitute the foundation of the current international liberal order.
And Trita, as we start to wrap up, what will you be looking for in the next days and weeks for indicators about where the White House might be going on this?
I will actually keep most of my eyes on the Europeans, because I think what we're going to end up seeing likely is that they're actually going to beef up their involvement in the deal in order to ensure that it survives. Instead of giving Trump any concessions, they're going to move closer and deeper into the deal in order to make sure that it potentially could survive without the United States in it.
And who are the main European leaders who might really step forward on this?
Well, you have the Brits, the Germans, and the French. And Macron has been very vocal on this. And then, quite interestingly, Britain, who usually tends to be a little bit closer to the U.S., particularly when there's differences between the U.S. and Europe, has taken a very, very clear position with the Europeans and very, very negatively towards what Trump is doing on this. The only two countries in the world that essentially are supporting what Trump is doing is Israel and Saudi Arabia, two countries that incidentally want the United States to go to war with Iran.
Well, Trita, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Trita Parsi is the founder and president of the National Iranian American Council and author of the book Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Snow days are a fact of life in the upper Midwest, but not all snow day announcements are the same. Administrators at the Cumberland School District here in Wisconsin decided to have some fun with their announcement last week. They made a video, and it started off with a celebrity cameo.
Hey there, Cumberland Beavers! It's AJ from the Backstreet Boys. I hear you guys have some pretty nasty weather out there. Yeah, it's a snow day. And here to tell you why is Mr. Nargis and the entire administrative team. You're having a snow day. Stay warm.
They changed the Backstreet Boys song from I Want It That Way to Today Is a Snow Day. And that was Backstreet Boy AJ McLean introducing the video. The video was a group effort with administrators, teachers, and students all making it happen. We'll leave you with part of the song. You can find the whole video on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
Morning, parents, don't wake your student, believe when we say.